One of our favorite times, conversations with Linda. Questions, stories, whatever, jump on board as we come right back. Welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe with us. And Linda, you will not be with us next month. You've got some great news, don't
yes,
you?
My daughter is getting married in Philadelphia, and July is going to be a month of festivities before, during, and after, and it's a really joyous time, and it's kind of one of those special moments, and especially on this planet that seems so agitated and precarious
and dangerous
every day. And so we are going to try, I guess, to put ourselves in a bubble for the month of July and try to be happy and joyful, because it is a wonderful time. And what I started to say before the break, ever since the dog fire is what they called it up in the Manzanos, started about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago here.
Right.
And it was joined by smoke that was coming in from California. We were getting all kinds of messages from the weather people and others about the newspaper. Well, I and a whole lot of people I know, we began coughing, sneezing. Whatever comes in with these fires sometimes, you just wonder, what is it that is burning, in this case, west of us or east of us, both, and combines and comes in, and nobody knows for certain what they are breathing. That is another one of the big unknowns today, is that stuff can be carried with some of these fires that seem to be getting bigger and worse, that can make humans and animals sick.
Linda, I had an opportunity to interview Buzz Aldrin for just a little bit, and he was talking about how he used a Bic pen to get off the surface of the moon, because he had to push it down on the switch. He couldn't fit his glove down there.
Oh, my God.
But I also was on with him with Larry King years ago on the Larry King Show, and he really never talked about UFOs. Has he changed his tune?
Yeah, just in the last year. And that's what Ken Johnson meant about, he was glad to see Buzz Aldrin coming out of the closet.
Is he serious, or is he trying to pull our legs?
Oh, no, no. It's extremely serious. There are so much that I have heard. I think for me personally, the most dramatic discussion that I ever had about Apollo 11 was with a jet pilot who had grown up with Neil Armstrong when they were teenagers to their early 20s, and they both had become pilots. And I was a supervising producer on the pilot for the Sighting series, working in Los Angeles for about 5 months. And one of the things that we wanted to do was to interview as many astronauts mm-hmm. as we could. And at the top of my list as a producer was Neil Armstrong.
Even though he hated being interviewed, didn't
he? And why did he hate being interviewed? This is where this story comes in. So it was recommended that I get in touch with this man who had been a colleague of Neil's for so long, and people have bonds from high school and 20s that can last for a lifetime. And so I was able to get a dinner meeting with this pilot, and this is what he told me. He said that after Apollo 11 crew got back after the July 69 first step on the moon, eventually he made contact with Neil Armstrong, and that he could tell in Neil's voice that something was off. And he ended up going over to the house. And here, you would think in 69 after July that Neil Armstrong would be joyous, that he would have photographs of all the stuff they did on the moon.
Oh, my God, it's exciting.
The landing and that it would be a big deal, right?
And life-changing and epiphany, everything.
You would think. And the pilot said in the house there was not one photograph. Not one photograph.
I find that weird.
Armstrong involved with anything having to do with that the Apollo 11? And he said, Neil, what is wrong? And Neil said, and he said the voice dropped, and like they're really buddies. And he said, we were coming down, and there were these three big silver disks, and they were waiting for us and watching us. And the way the pilot told me is that Neil Armstrong was angry. The implication was, no matter what they had been debriefed, whether or not NASA knew or expected that there would be anything like that, the very fact that it occurred and our government had had knowledge, our government has had knowledge about an alien presence on this planet since at least World War II. This is 1969. These guys are being trained to go into space. They're being trained to go around the moon, and in this case, to land on the moon. And if somebody didn't sit them down and really talk to them about the complex nature, as William Mills Tompkins and others are increasingly whistleblowing about, the complexity of multiple intelligences involved in this solar system, with this Earth, with our history, with genetic evolution, the whole nine yards, then seeing three big silver disks on the crater edge would perhaps have been a shock to their system, even if momentarily. And I think that that comment that Ken Johnson made about a psychiatrist who was debriefing each one of the crews for days, for weeks when they came back, and raising the question, were they programmed in some way to forget? And if so, would that help explain that Neil Armstrong was conditioned not to talk, but on top of all of that, that he perhaps felt a certain kind of disconnect and maybe even anger over the fact that here we were pretending NASA as a public agency that was supposed to be encouraging students and teachers and everything, but that in fact that it was schizophrenic with one face to the public, but a huge part that was allied with the CIA and the NSA having to deal with an alien presence on Earth, on the moon, and throughout the solar system and beyond, and that that would really get to you if you were training to go into space and then have three big silver disks waiting for you on the moon. And that apparently is the main reason, according to the pilot, that Neil Armstrong stayed silent for the rest of his life.
He was married twice, and both of his wives, I don't know if they're still alive or not, but wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
To talk to this, let's see, he was married to Janet Sheeran when he landed on the moon. You need to find out for us if she's still alive, and if you could interview her, because I'm sure he told his wife something about what he saw on the moon. I don't know if anybody's ever interviewed her.
Well, and William Mills Tompkins describes it in detail and says he saw the photos. That there were photos, the running camera, the same thing that we just heard from Ken Johnson and from Donna Hare in terms of all the photographs and the images and the film, and that William Mills Tompkins says that he saw the photograph of the big three silver disc with his own eyes on the crater.
And he had three children by her, and so maybe they will talk too.
Well, it's definitely worth trying.
Oh, my God, what a great interview that would be.
Don't you begin to get the feeling, George, that the whole planet is beginning to wake up inside of a Star Trek episode, but the truth is it's all real, all of it, good and bad, non-humans, as Lynn Buchanan has remote viewed. William, just like William Mills Tompkins says, that there are the marauders, controllers versus more spiritual and positive ones. that there really are Star Wars, there's galactic trade, and we have been forced into such, we'll say, suppressed knowledge for so long as a civilization that it is becoming amazing that all of the so-called fiction based on fact that we've been exposed to since the day the Earth stood still has been like drops leading up to this part of the century where we may finally start getting all of the truth beyond whistleblowers from our own government. They have to tell us the truth. We should be demanding that we be told the truth.
Yeah. We'll turn you loose on this to be sure. By the way, he got involved in a legal dispute with his barber because the barber sold locks of his hair.
Neil Armstrong's hair?
Yeah, for $3,000 a pop or something.
Oh, like my gosh.
Unbelievable. Let's go to the phones for you, Linda. We'll go to Thomas in La Jolla, California to get things started. Thomas, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call, George. I really appreciate
it. You're very welcome.
I just truly appreciate it. I'm sure the Coast audience appreciates your top shelf investigative journalism, and we're truly grateful.
Thank you so much.
My question for you, Linda, is it's just fascinating what you have to report about the, you know, about the lunar photographs, etc. Do the Russian and Chinese space agencies, have there been any whistleblowers? I mean, the Russians were the first to film the backside of the moon.
Right, and they named those big craters.
Right, absolutely. And then, of course, the Chinese now, they have the lunar rover on the moon. There has to be some sort of chatter, so to speak, within the Russian and Chinese professionals, concerning photographs, concerning the alien presence.
Well, the most fascinating discussion I have had about China, for example, and what do they know, what do other countries know, was with Scott Jones, and he was the Navy intel guy that Senator Pell hired in the mid-70s to go to China officially. It was all authorized by the State Department. Had all the papers, and Scott did an interview with me about 10 years ago telling the whole story. And that the what Senator Pell wanted Scott Jones to do was to find out as much as possible about the, what the Chinese had in photographs, film, documents, and so forth related to UFOs and ETs. And how they introduced all of this, I'm not certain, but Scott said it was all prepared and he had Chinese government handlers, and after being there for about 2 weeks, he said, Linda, I saw everything we all want to see. He said, there are photographs, there's film, they have craft, they have bodies, they have everything. And that at the end, before he left, he asked through his translator to the political representative, you have everything the world wants to know. Why are you not making what you have public? And that the Chinese political person bowed with their hands together. And when he stood back up, the translator said these words to Scott Jones from the United States. We are waiting for the United States to act. Well, then Scott and I had a very interesting discussion. Could that mean that when Richard Nixon, as president, broke the ice going to China, was it really a cover trip to talk with the Chinese through translators about precisely that, that the United States may have made an agreement with Mao to keep everything to the Chinese, letting the United States continue to be the kind of major organizer and strategizer about the extraterrestrial presences, and that there was an agreement a silent agreement, maybe a secret executive agreement, and that we are still living the legacy of these discussions and these, executive signed and non-disclosed agreements that might have been made about keeping the United States as the one that everybody is waiting for to open it all up, and but the other countries, such as China, Scott Jones says they've got everything. And today, in 2016, why are the Chinese not acting independently?
Let's go to Skip now in Warren, Ohio. Welcome to the show, Skip.
How you doing?
Good.
Thank you for taking my call. Linda, I want to mention something that I mentioned to George earlier. You mentioned a pyramid at the South Pole. Well, I was listening to a ham radio operator on a scanner discuss something that they were discussing. It sounded like an Art Bell show, so I listened, and they were talking about HAARP, and they talked about also abductions, and the most the really one that got my attention was the fact that one of the guys asked, do you think we'll ever time travel? And one of the guys piped up, said, you know, I retired from the Navy a month ago, but 3 months before I retired, he said that I'm also bound by my security clearance. He says, so I'm going to tell you what I can and nothing more, so don't ask me no questions. Everybody agreed, and he said, I was in a pyramid that had never been opened before 3 months before I retired. He said, also, he says, in that pyramid, we found a 4,000-year-old contemporary computer.
Ah.
A 4,000-year-old contemporary computer.
Probably runs better than ours do right now.
And what your implication is that there was an overlay in time of something from the future here?
No, I think that, they say you can't go back in time, and I believe that.
Well, no, I mean, no. Mathematically and theoretically, going back in time is very feasible in the space-time continuum of this universe.
Right, you can do it, but you have to have a machine that was turned on, like today. If we turned on a machine, we would be able to go forward as far as the point where it was turned off. So if you want to go back, you have to have access to a machine that had been turned off back to where you want to go.
Huh, that's an interesting take. Linda, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with much more conversations with Linda. Those of you who have been on hold, just hang there. We'll get to you as well. Linda Moultonhawe, and again, our website, earthfiles.com, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. As for us, don't forget to like us on Facebook, if you would, and follow us on Twitter. You can do all that by going to coasttocoastam.com, far right-hand corner. We'll be back. Welcome back. Linda Moultonhawe with us. Linda, any other trips coming up for you other than the Philadelphia wedding?
When I get back in August, I'm going to be speaking in Phoenix at Phoenix MUFON. Then I have a couple of more trips, and that gets me into September. And it's like a whole bunch of stuff starts happening in September, October, November.
Gosh.
Have you ever felt like that in this world now, I don't know if it's the digital influence or what it is, but simply finding quiet hours to read, which is so important to do to actually understand things, is becoming more and more difficult.
What about time, Linda? Isn't this a fast year? Why does it seem so fast?
Well, I am not sure myself, but each year we say the same thing. It seems like each year is getting faster and faster.
Yep.
And it doesn't seem to be age dependent. I know people in their 30s, their 20s, they're saying the same thing, that they feel like, one friend of mine said the other day, she feels like the old visual of a hamster running in a cage, and it's going around faster and faster, the faster the hamster runs, but the hamster can't get out.
Well, you know, my oldest granddaughter just turned 22, and it just seems like yesterday she was running around in diapers.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just...
Everything is just seemingly...
so fast.
Yeah, there's just so much all the time, and sleep becomes like this necessary interruption.
I'm going on 14 years doing Coast to Coast. Can you imagine that?
Well, 2004.
2003 I started in January, so we're going to go for 14 next January. I mean, where does the time go?
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's been that long, because I've been working with you ever since in Philadelphia when you took over for Art.
Well, you know what? My executive producer, Lisa, sent me a note a couple days ago, and she said, do you know that you now have been doing Coast to Coast on a syndicated basis longer than Art did? And I went, you got to be kidding me. She said,
wow.
She said, no.
Well, that's true, because Coast started, I think, in 1995. We had been doing Dreamland on weekends, and then Coast started. So if it started in 95, then 2005 would have been 10 years, and he left.
He left in 2003.
Yeah.
Amazing. Oh, well, let's go to some final calls here for you. We go west. Brock is in the state of Washington. Brock, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
I called you guys about earlier in the year when you were on the show, Linda, and it was about traveling in outer space, and you said, somebody was working on something where you could go the quarter the speed of light.
Right, that is what they call
them, and I don't know if you remember.
Yes, they're called wafer craft, and they're being designed and developed by several different academics and companies. And the idea is that you would use lasers and have the photons push lightweight and small wafer, that's why they call them wafer craft, and that the brains in the wafer craft would be like an iPhone. An iPhone is really quite a sophisticated computer, and something about the size and the complexity of an iPhone could be the brains in this small wafer. And within once they turn on the laser beam on the wafer craft, in 3 minutes, depending upon whether they reach 25% or 30% the speed of light, in 3 minutes, the wafer craft could be going whizzing by Mars. That's how fast they could go.
That's amazing. I love technology stories, don't you?
And it's just, this is part of that feeling like waking up in the middle of a Star Trek. It's coming so fast. Our government must have amazing things that they're keeping away from terrestrial enemies, but that we are, George, if when Lynn Buchanan says that he knows somebody inside the government who is managing galactic trade between Earth and aliens, it's like we all need to catch up.
I mean, it's amazing. I'm not sure I believe everything. But there are amazing stories out there.
From Joe McMonagle to Lynn Buchanan and others, they've remote viewed, and I think they are remote viewing facts. I really do. We've talked a lot of them. Jim Mars and I, for sure, have talked with a lot of them.
Elaine is in Fort Myers, Florida. Good morning, Elaine.
Hi. Good morning, Linda and George.
Hi.
Just a very simple comment. From everything you're saying, and you know everything we are listening to, it's just so obvious that everybody's waiting for some big reveal and announcement and all that. And that's really, I mean, they already have. Whoever they are, aliens, interdimensional, or whoever they all are, they all the stuff is here. It's our fault that
they're definitely making us talk more and more and more, meaning that it is not something that came in swooping and destroying. It has been a cat and mouse game that has kept humans intrigued and trying to understand for a long time, and now it is coming in waves hitting the beach. And I think that when the intensity of the energy is this much, and every day there's more and more coming, it has to be that we are building up to perhaps a collaboration between one of the alien types and our government and other governments, that they know they cannot keep all these fingers in the holes in the dike that they've been trying to. Today, I received a photograph that is being studied by a colleague, and I hope to be doing a story about this. And honest to God, George, it is without doubt such an obvious painting of a sand dune on Mars that you just kind of say, this is either stupid or a mistake. And if it's not stupid and a mistake, it is somebody that wants to see if the public will see this corny, flat, it doesn't even pretend to look like a modeled sand dune. It just looks like a flat wave that's been placed on a section of Mars. It's that obvious. And would somebody, is that what would be happening inside now today, where there are people who are responsible for airbrushing out alien stuff on Mars and the Moon and Ceres and so forth throughout the solar system? Are they becoming so frustrated that they're now trying to get pictures out to see if images will start talk because they are so obvious?
We now have Jason in Texas, first-time caller. Jason, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, Jason. Thank you.
How are you doing, ma'am?
Hi.
I just wanted to touch base with y'all and ask y'all if y'all have ever heard of Carol Watts and any encounter that he had over Wellington, Texas in 1967?
No.
That you've never heard of that story?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, I was just curious if anybody...
Can you just give a short summary? Was it an abduction? What happened?
Well, what happened was he had basically been coming from his dad's... it happened south of Wellington, Texas in 1967. He was coming from his dad's farm going to his house, and he had thought somebody was prowling around their barn, but the story tells like this. It says, I was traveling on south on US 83 at this ain't it. Anyway, the bottom line of the story is that the guy said that he saw a craft that was 100 foot long and
like a cylinder, I think, if I recall that story. And didn't he have incredible publicity to the point, Jason, where it almost ruined his family?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I remember that case.
Yes, sir.
George, it was a low-flying cylinder?
Yes, and there were a couple sightings of this thing out there in that Wellington, Texas area, and he even got to a point, Carol Watts, and it's a guy, he got to the point where, because he was trying to explain what had happened to him, he got involved in some kind of hoax confession that came back and bit him in the tail, too. Wasn't that what happened to him, Jason?
Yes, sir. Carol Watts disclosed the reason behind the false hoax confession. If you want to read about it, you can just, pull up a story, UFO.
And Carol Watts.
It's a great story.
This is one of those, again, where something real happens. And then people become overwhelmed by either having to defend themselves or whatever it is. And then they go too far, and then they have a hoax claim. And once there's a hoax claim, that's it.
It gets knocked
off the books. It's not fair, but it happens all the time. And the government understands this. Counterintelligence understands this. that to keep knocking the pins off. It's so easy if they put something out that discredits the person, discredits the time, discredits the date, whatever it is, and they are skilled chess players on the cases where they do not want the public and the media to take something seriously. Counter intel is extremely sophisticated in the so-called deflection through hoax claims. So I myself am always suspicious when there is a obvious hoax claim,
yep,
because underneath is probably something real.
That's a good point. I remember there was a case in Michigan. Gosh, I must have been 17 when J. Allen Hynek came to town, and he got hit with the swamp gas thing.
Oh,
remember that one?
Oh, gosh, yes. And he told me in that year before he died that it was one of his biggest regrets.
Yes.
And that he wanted so much to be vindicated in his life. He didn't know at the time that he was dying of a brain tumor that had spread apparently from prostate cancer. But he wanted to be vindicated, and in his huge, passionate desire to be vindicated, he was basically telling me and his friend Richard Sigismund that he knew for a fact there were craft, there were aliens, the extraterrestrials. Why would an astronomer who had been at Northwestern and Ohio State leave his prestigious career and found centers for UFO studies if he hadn't been exposed to the reality of all of this? George Allen knew.
He knew.
Allen knew it was all real and it's serious, and he was hoping it would come out in his lifetime. For this to be 2016 and still covered under these layers of policies of denial is absurd.
And the flip-flop he did, going from an apparent non-believer to a staunch believer, was absolutely riveting.
Well, it isn't belief. It's based on hard data.
Yeah.
If you had walked in my shoes through all of the animal mutilations I have investigated.
No, I'm not wearing high heels. Not going to happen.
No, it's not high heels. It's boots. going out into pastures where you then end up with veterinarians and with law enforcement, and they're telling you and showing you where a heart has been removed, and they're talking about molecular surgery. You are not in the land of terrestrial medicine.
Let's go to Dylan in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, east of the Rockies. Hey, Dylan, go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, Linda.
Hi.
I just wanted to, Linda, get your opinion on the something that's kind of been a buzz lately on the Internet, which is basically this idea that, you know, they're lying about, you know, the space, like the NASA and everything, a lot of that.
About everything.
Lies. Yeah, and but specifically, there's a book which is an account of by a guy named Olaf Janssen.
Yes.
His trip to Antarctica in supposedly 1811, and then also the books by Admiral Richard E. Byrd.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk a lot about, you know, the inner Earth and, you know, Antarctica, more particularly the North Pole, and the fact that there's another civilization up there, basically, that's like 1,000 years more advanced than us, and that a lot of what the NASA is telling us is actually aliens from outer space. It's actually local to Earth, and they're here.
Well, that's the phrase, alien presence. Goes back to John F. Kennedy. This is the story that I did last year at Earth Files and Coast, having to do with Caddy, who was the attorney who got the Watergate burglars out that night. And Caddy was a friend of E. Howard Hunt's. And Daniel List of Dark Journalists and I did a long program about all of this. And Caddy did an interview with Daniel List. And then I was using it at Earth Files and on Coast, in which he said that E. Howard Hunt told him before E. Howard Hunt died that the reason that John F. Kennedy was assassinated was because he wanted to open up meaning go public with the alien presence on the earth, and that was the phrase they were using in the 60s.
Wow. And we heard that Marilyn Monroe got killed because of the same thing.
Exactly, and I think that's absolutely true. And we have to get past this. Nobody should be dying because governments have policies of 1984 Orwellian, upside down, bass backwards, that we're still alone in the universe. Oh, come on. We should be all... The entire human family should be embracing the fact we're not alone in the universe, it's very complex, and that the alien presence on this planet goes right to the heart of these huge caverns that William Mills Tompkins said that the government discovered in World War II all over the planet, and they have always been bases for various kinds of alien presences coming and going, and that part of this, part of the drama of the Earth and the relationship to all of this, we'll call it the galactic theater of what we are living in this universe, is that Atlantis and Lemuria and Mesopotamia, the Anunnaki, all of it, the Greeks, they weren't gods. None of them were gods.
No, they weren't. Linda, enjoy Philadelphia. Enjoy the wedding. We'll talk to you in August. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borelson, George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.